Mr. Colin Wallace was employed by a government to tell lies. And indeed, he was a very squalid part of what was a very squalid operation in the north of Ireland at that period of time.
Colin Wallace lived for the British Army. Headhunted in 1968 for the press office in Lisburn, he rose quickly to the rank of Lieutenant Colonel. But the mood in Northern Ireland was changing, and from 1970, in addition to his regular press office duties, Wallace began working with MI5 on so-called psychological operations. In 1974, when assigned to a top-secret project called Clockwork Orange, Colin Wallace had a choice to make.
The basic plan of Clockwork Orange was to feed information to the press to discredit specific individuals and organisations. And although the core of that was certainly about paramilitary groups on both sides, it was clear that a lot of it was highly damaging to key political figures, including the leader of the Labour Party. They believed that the Labour government was under the control or influence of the Soviet Union, and because of their attitude, I suppose, in Ireland, that this was a threat to the security of the realm. And the idea basically was to plant information, and we also had forged documents to substantiate some of this information. We had a false bank account on behalf of a senior Labour minister, and the idea was to create a dossier overall and then give that dossier either in whole or in part to a number of key journalists and then really use them as conduits to get the information to the public. So, bearing in mind that this information was being disseminated during 1974, when there were two general elections in process, the possible implications were enormous. And by mid-1974, I had very mixed emotions. A lot of what I was doing ran totally contrary to what I believed in. I was spending my time engaged in political activity and attempting also to discredit, had I gone ahead with the project, democratically elected politicians. Again, totally opposite to what the security forces should have been doing. So I suppose my emotions range from being frightened because I had no one I could really talk to just overall concern about being deflected away from my main role, which was defeating terrorism. And to me, that was a complete waste of my time, energy and resources. And so as the time passed, I think my frustrations and indeed even fears grew. I seemed totally powerless to be able to find a way out of it.
It was disturbing in the extreme. If military intelligence was plotting to undermine Prime Minister Harold Wilson, then the army was effectively in mutiny against its supposed political masters.
I had several meetings with my MI5 contact during the middle and late summer. And at those meetings, I was expressing my growing concern. And eventually it got to the point where I realised that I would have to make a decision. And at that stage, I thought the best way to do was really to call his bluff by saying that I really need written authority. I was trying to say in a matter-of-fact way that in the normal course of events, any activity of this nature needs ministerial clearance. And because of the nature of the information I was handling, that I felt that the time was right for that clearance to be given to me. And then at a follow-up meeting, I said that in the absence of that authority that I couldn't engage in the operation anymore. So it was a very, very strange, uncomfortable session because it's also very unlike me. I don't like to be put in a situation where I'm challenging my own authority because most of the time I believe passionately in what I was doing. This was an occasion where I had to go against all my instincts to really achieve what I felt I had to.
But the Clockwork Orange project wasn't his only concern that summer. For 2 years now, Wallace had been trying, unsuccessfully, to get something done about alleged child sex abuse at a Belfast home for boys.
In 1972, I received a phone call from a social worker, and she said she had some information for the security forces and arranged to meet me. And can remember the woman fairly clearly, slightly plump, round face. I can remember she was wearing glasses with fairly large spectacle frames. She told me that she had been involved in the supervision of one particular boy from West Belfast who claimed to have been sexually abused at the Kinkora boys' home in Belfast. She said that she and her colleagues had raised the matter with the authorities, but nothing had been done. The basic story was that boys in the home were being abused, but also boys from the home were taken out or went out to pre-arranged meetings with individuals in the surrounding area. And the main reason that we were interested was that there were strong links with the loyalist paramilitary community, particularly in East Belfast. I was surprised that, bearing in mind the nature of the allegations, and particularly bearing in mind the fact that we had good working relationships with the RUC, that nothing had been done a year later. And I wrote a fairly strongly worded memo highlighting my concern about the lack of any activity in that respect. I think, too, first of all, I felt very frustrated that nothing had happened. And the fact that children were being abused when they were in the care of the authorities seemed particularly horrific.
In fact, systematic sex abuse at Kinkora would continue unchallenged for another 6 years. Significantly, it would later emerge that the loyalist paramilitary leader who ran the home was also working for MI5. After sending his angry memo, Colin Wallace, who had been promoted just weeks earlier, suddenly found himself a very unpopular man.
After I had written the memo about Kinkora, and after I had decided not to go ahead with Clockwork Orange, I felt life would settle down and I could get back into much more of my traditional form of working. But suddenly, out of the blue, without any warning, David McDyne, the Chief Information Officer at Northern Ireland, told me that I had been requested to go to Minister's Defence as a matter of urgency just before Christmas. And in fact, the only time that I could manage to do it comfortably was on Christmas Eve, which was really the beginning of my holiday. So I travelled to Minister's Defence main building, and it was a strange and quite hostile interview, which I didn't expect. Very brisk. I was summoned to his office. He said quite bluntly, after a pleasantry, that they had information that my life was in danger and that I was being moved out of Northern Ireland as a matter of urgency. And I did say to him that I found that strange, bearing in mind that I had just been promoted into a new job. The fact it was hard to see how my life was at risk when I was living in perhaps the most secure garrison in the whole of Northern Ireland. But he just literally wouldn't discuss it at all. He said that was the information he had, and that's what had to happen, and I had to make a choice between one of two locations. So it wasn't a particularly pleasant start to the Christmas holiday. Of course, mulling it over during the holiday period when I had no one to talk to then, all sorts of things came to mind as to what the real reason behind it might be. And I went on holiday feeling very apprehensive, to put it mildly.
After the holiday, Wallace had just a few days to prepare to leave for Preston in the northwest of England. Eileen, his girlfriend and future wife, who also worked in the intelligence services, was transferred to London. On his last day in Northern Ireland, Wallace had one final task to do in his disinformation role. It involved leaking a bogus internal document to the Times journalist Robert Fisk, the sort of thing Wallace had been doing daily for years.
I loaded up my belongings and transported them down to Belfast docks to go on a Royal Navy ship to be transported across to Liverpool. I travelled to the docks, and because of sort of our standard training, I noticed that there was a car following me and did a number of turns down to actually the docks itself and found that this car was still following me. Getting quite concerned at that stage about who was actually in the car, I then called into a military barracks on the way back to Lisburn, and I was surprised to see that the vehicle actually came into the barracks with me. So it was quite clear that they had some official connection. But then as I travelled back to Lisburn, the car followed me again. And I suppose at that stage, beginning to get slightly paranoid about what was going on. And when I got to the outskirts of Lisburn, and I did a few turns around the side streets of Lisburn, and came out on the Hillsborough Road and lost them. And so I travelled out to Robert Fisk's house near Hillsborough, went to the door. He wasn't at home, so I put the document I was going to brief him on to the letterbox and left. And when I moved from Northern Ireland, I'd been there literally 24 hours and was having lunch in this beautiful oak-panelled dining room when the chief of staff, a brigadier, said to me, oh, there are two visitors to see you in my office. So I went straight from lunch to the office and found two gentlemen sitting there in smart suits who introduced themselves as detective superintendent in the special branch. And they said that they were investigating the fact that I had, without authority, disclosed a classified document to a journalist. And it was clear during the interview that they knew nothing about what my real job was in Northern Ireland. And when I was asked about the document, I made it clear that I couldn't answer any questions until I had clearance from the Minister of Defence in London. I then contacted the Minister of Defence and asked for guidance on what I should do. I was told at that stage that I could make a statement to the police, but I could not make any reference to my classified job description, nor was I allowed to make any reference to attempts to discredit politicians. And I foolishly went along with it, believing that because the system knew really what I was doing, that they would resolve the matter satisfactorily. So I think when the police officers left, I was in a state of shock. I was thoroughly confused because there was nobody I could speak to. I did try to ring my former boss at Lisburn, and I was told he wasn't available. And it was clear that at that stage, really, no one wanted to know. So I had nobody to talk to. And I suppose when there's a total vacuum and when you have no outlet for that, one gets more and more paranoid about what's going on. So it was a dreadful experience, but I still thought it, somewhere along the line, it's a misunderstanding. I was always imagining the best that the system was going to do things right. And there was no reason why I should have suspected otherwise. I mean, you know, my promotion and everything else, and although all the indications were there that things were going wrong, I suppose I didn't want to believe that and I didn't want to see that. But I certainly was very, very worried, to put it mildly. It was a nightmare. No, there's no question of that.
Wallace was suspended from his new job pending a disciplinary hearing in London. But under the Official Secrets Act, his MI5 handlers ordered Wallace not to reveal his true job description at the hearing. As a mere press officer, it would be impossible for him to justify having leaked a classified document. If there was one man who could save the day, that was Wallace's former boss at Lisburn, who was called to appear at the hearing. When the day came, however, Wallace was told that he had missed his flight. For months, Wallace had nothing to do but wait in the barracks for the outcome.
In June of 1975, I was in the officers' mess at Preston, and I was told by one of the mess staff that the general, the GOC, wanted to see me. I went to his office and he asked me to sit down. Again, this remarkable, almost baronial hall background, quite surreal. And he said, I have to read this letter to you formally. And he read through the letter exactly as it was. But in effect, formally at that point, I was told that I could resign with effect from the end of that year, or I could be sacked. There was no choice, it was either or. And I was found guilty, therefore, of giving a classified document to a journalist without authority, even though that's what I did for a large part of the time, giving fake classified documents. So I was clear in my own mind that what had happened to me was the result of my refusal to go ahead with Clockwork Orange. I was absolutely convinced, because of the way people in the know responded to me, that I was being set up, or certainly I was being used as a fall guy, that if anything went wrong, I was going to be blamed for what had happened. And so that was the point where the scales tipped and I realised that there was no way back. They weren't going to be fair, they weren't going to be honest about it. They were out to get me.
Over the next 18 months, Wallace was offered four separate jobs, only to have each offer withdrawn when the employer sought references from the Ministry of Defence. Finally, in late 1976, he got a job with the local authority in the south of England, and for the next few years, life had apparently returned to normal. By 1980, Wallace was so settled in his new life that he agreed to speak off the record to an Irish Times journalist. The newspaper published allegations that there had been an MI5 plot in 1974 to undermine Prime Minister Harold Wilson. For those in the know, it wasn't hard to identify the source. They could have been forgiven too for suspecting that Wallace was also behind another newspaper's expose that same year of the Kinkora sex abuse scandal, which led to the home's closure. Events quickly took a sinister turn. A friend of Wallace's turned up dead in the local river, and the Home Office pathologist ruled out foul play. But after Colin Wallace was arrested in connection with the death, the same pathologist changed his mind. Now, he thought, it had been murder. Skeptics may ridicule him for it, but Colin Wallace says he was being deliberately framed.
The police officers arrived in a civilian car. They literally came to the door, said, "Can we come in?" Eileen and I were both in the living room, the lounge. They just walked into the room. The senior officer said, "You're being charged with the murder of Jonathan Lewis." Went through the formal procedure. Wasn't handcuffed. Taken out, put in the back seat of the car, taken to Littlehampton Police Station, and basically locked up. Appeared in court first thing the next morning, and then taken from the court to Lewis Prison.
The trial of Colin Wallace was highly publicised. Wallace had been romantically linked with the victim's wife before her husband's death, and the prosecution argued that he had murdered for love. The trouble was that there was no hard evidence that Jonathan Lewis had been killed, never mind that he had been killed by Colin Wallace. The circumstantial evidence seemed contradictory, and Wallace asserted his innocence throughout. In the end, the murder charge was thrown out by the judge, who asked the jury instead to consider a charge of manslaughter.
Somebody once said to me, "Beware when the jury won't look at you when they come in." And I could remember that very clearly because the jury filed in and not one of them looked my direction, whereas normally they look over to see how you're taking things. And they came up with the unanimous verdict, guilty. So the judge then sent me to 10 years and I was immediately taken downstairs and handcuffed to wait for the prison van to escort me out. My lawyer was allowed to come down and see me, my barrister, and they brought Eileen with them, but I only had a few minutes. I was then taken out, put in a prison van, and I arrived in Wormwood Scrubs Prison at about 9 o'clock, I think, at night. It was late on anyhow. And that's one of the things that really stuck in my mind. It was blowing windy and driving rain, and I can remember being escorted from the prison van into the reception area. And I was escorted with a prison officer with dogs. You know, you suddenly go from one end of the scale. I was part of the security forces, and within a short space of time, I'm being escorted as a high-risk prisoner. But you have to go through the whole indignity of the system. You have to get stripped, showered. Got to my cell, and lots of the plaster had fallen off the wall, and it was lying on the floor. And there was this incredibly bad stained mattress. If you had to make a horror film about prisons, this would have been it. It was really bad. So made my bed up and literally just curled up in bed and went to sleep. And I can remember waking up in the morning with the door opening. And this prison officer looked in and he said, "Read all about yourself." And he threw me a copy of the Daily Telegraph.
For Colin Wallace, life had come undone. Now nobody would believe what he had to say about out-of-control intelligence agencies and the cover-up of abuse at Kinkora. Certainly his imprisonment was convenient for the targets of his criticism. Wallace felt it was more than a coincidence.
It was quite clear at that stage that the trigger seemed to be Kinkora, and at that stage I thought that the intelligence services believed I knew more than I did about Kinkora, and therefore that if I did give evidence to an inquiry, I could be really very damaging to them. And I think to this day that what happened to me was an attempt, or several attempts, to discredit what I might say about Kinkora. And an Army intelligence officer at Lisburn, after I left, complained about Kinkora exactly the same as I was summoned to MOD and was told that he would be disciplined if he continued with it. But I think the intelligence service was using it as a means to put pressure on, to blackmail, to get people to do what they wanted to do.
During Wallace's 6 years in prison, it emerged that many boys from Kinkora had made complaints to various authorities, but no action had ever been taken. Investigators sought interviews with Wallace, but the Ministry of Defence denied permission for him to speak freely. Meanwhile, a banned book called Spycatcher was making headlines, claiming sensationally that MI5 in the 1970s had been plotting against the Labour government.
Suddenly, out of the blue, came the story of Peter Wright. And Peter Wright, of course, I knew because he'd been in Northern Ireland in my time. And it was amazing because something I had said and put on record years ago, had still got my notes of that, here was a senior MI5 officer, believe it or not, saying the same thing. I mean, this was absolute manna from heaven. I couldn't believe that this was happening. So, of course, I started writing again furiously to the Prime Minister and everybody else. But, you know, you could imagine that with the sensitivity of that, the last thing they wanted was, you know, a convict who was raising trouble as well. And in the middle of the, when I was really on my last stage of coming out without parole, I was sitting in my cell one day at lunchtime when the door opened and the prison officer came in and said, the governor wants to see you. And he said, you're going home. And that was it. And all the prisoners were actually really kind. They were all coming around before and sort of, lots of them had made cards and stuff and shoved it onto the door. And I packed up all my belongings I'd acquired over the years, my books and bits and pieces, put it all in a cardboard box. And there were just dozens of press everywhere when we came out because they all wanted to know about Peter Wright, Spycatcher and all the rest of it.
He was out of prison, but the campaign continued. As far as Wallace was concerned, he still had an unfair dismissal and a false conviction for manslaughter to overturn. In 1987, a young Labour MP, Ken Livingstone, used his maiden speech in the Commons to highlight Wallace's claims. But Thatcher continued to deny the existence of Clockwork Orange and that Wallace had been anything more than a press officer.
The phone rang and it was my Member of Parliament and he said, there's going to be a statement in the House about you tomorrow. And he said, I have no idea, they're not telling me what it's going to be. And the next day, Secretary of State for Defence Tom King announced that the government had, quote, inadvertently misled Parliament over my case. And they had now found files that indicated that I had a job in certain areas and it was classified. And as a result of what they found, they had commissioned Sir David Calcutt to carry out an investigation. So it was suddenly on the news because as soon as it was announced in the House, there was a sort of a major eruption because MPs were suddenly saying we've been misled. And all the people who put down questions who were told there was not a shred of evidence to support anything I said, you know, were clamouring now for blood.
I have come to this House to report on a matter on which we are clear that a mistake has been made and we are anxious to remedy that at the earliest possible opportunity. And people jumping up and down, one after the other, and I could join the club.
It was a most extraordinary U-turn. The government was now conceding that Colin Wallace had a secret job title in the 1970s, that there had been a psychological operations unit at Lisburn, and that Colin Wallace had been involved with a disinformation project called Clockwork Orange. They continued to deny, however, that there had been any cover-up of Kinkora or a plot to undermine the Labour government. The inquiry found that Colin Wallace had been wrongly dismissed from his job and that those dismissing him had known the dismissal to be wrongful at the time. He was awarded compensation, but the manslaughter conviction remained.
Suddenly, Whitehall was beginning to question a lot of things that were happening. And then the Home Secretary announced that he was going to send the case back to the Court of Appeal for review. And it was at that point that the lawyers really got busy, brought in the forensic experts. But the appeal was terrific because I think then sitting there and having been on the receiving end of it when I was convicted and feeling frustrated and angry and almost finding it hard to believe what was being said, then to see the lawyers taking that case apart in the most sort of remarkable way and seeing the Crown case dissolve and seeing the Crown walking away from its own evidence was absolutely wonderful. And then there was that great day, I suppose, after all the years of ceasing to believe in anything, I went into the Court of Appeal, and I remember sitting with my solicitor on the side, and all the press were sitting, and the press got the result before I was told. They handed out the full transcript. And my solicitor ran down to the front, and he spoke to a journalist, and the journalist showed him the verdict. And then the journalist, not the guys who knew me, looked around and all laughed. That was it. So, great moment, really good moment. Powerful. And then the judge said, and you know, we're quashing both the conviction and the sentence. So that was just totally dissolved, the whole thing. We just sat there and we could hardly speak. We just, you know, it was just, what do you do now type of thing. After 20 years, it's a long time. And suddenly it's all over. So when I was charged, the first night I was in the police station, the officer in charge of the case turned to me and he said, you're going to find out who your true friends are. It was very true that from the very beginning, there were some surprising people who just literally risked a lot, huge amount, to stay with me. And there were other people I thought who really knew a lot about what I was doing, who just ran for cover at the slightest thing. But I don't for a moment consider myself to be a whistleblower, because fundamentally, I still believe passionately in what I was doing. I believe that when things did go wrong, had the mechanism existed for me to air my grievance and have it looked at properly, all of this would never have happened. At any time from I complained originally about Clockwork Orange or Concora, people could have come to me and said, what's this all about? My case would never have arisen. It's as simple as that. And to this day, I still feel uncomfortable with whistleblowers. But I think whistleblowers wouldn't exist if there was an outlet for genuine grievances.
Today, Colin Wallace lives with his wife in England, where he runs a team development and training company.